Welcome back to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast. I'm Dr. Michala Benson, a reader in sociology at Goldsmiths, University of London, and the research lead for a UK and a Changing Europe funded project that's all about what Brexit means for British citizens living in the EU27. In today's episode, I'm joined by another member of the British in Europe Steering Committee, Michael Harris. Michael, can I ask you to introduce yourself to start us off today?
Yeah, well, my name's Michael Harris. Actually, it's been changed because last year when I got Spanish nationality, I became Michael Harris Briarcliff, keeping my mother's name, which is a very nice thing I'm very pleased about. I'm the founder of Eurocitizens in Madrid and a member of the British in Europe Steering Group.
You've said that you're currently living in Madrid, obviously, and that's where Eurocitizens started up. And I think that Spain, when we think about British citizens who move to Spain, we wouldn't necessarily think about Madrid as a destination. So I was wondering if you could tell me a little bit about the circumstances under which you found yourself moving to and living in Madrid. And I know that you've been there for a long time as well, so it might be a bit of a longer story.
That's an understatement, Michala. Yeah, I came here in the beginning of 1982, so, you know, well back in the last century. And basically, I was an economic immigrant. I got back from South America. I was living in Britain for a few months. And I couldn't find a job. It was there was a recession under the first recession of Margaret Thatcher, I think. And anyway, I couldn't find a job. I knew people in Madrid, and I came to Madrid, and I got a job. I got work doing private teaching. So, in fact, actually, for a few months until I got a job in the British Council, I was an illegal immigrant.
What was it like moving to Spain at that time? Because I think it's really easy for us to think that the way the system that we've had until now of free movement within Europe was the way it always was. But I know that that's not the case. So I imagine that there were some things that you had to do when you arrived in Spain.
Well, when I got there, I mean, you had to, if you didn't have residence, you had to leave the country every 3 months. So everybody piled off on the train to the Portuguese border and you went out, went over the other side, had a coffee and then came back. I mean, obviously, they all knew about it, but that was the situation. And then I had to apply for residence. It was easier because I got a job in the British Council, so I had kind of pseudo-diplomatic status. But even then, it was quite daunting going to the immigration office with these sort of men with moustaches and dark glasses, kind of Franco-ish style, and they were not very friendly. It was not a very pleasant experience, and that's changed. I mean, freedom of movement didn't exist and you could come to Spain, but it wasn't that simple.
And I mean, you're talking about Spain also in a very different moment in its own history, I suppose. It's not the Spain that we know today that you'd moved to.
No, I mean, I didn't move there during the dictatorship. I moved there afterwards. I moved in 82. And actually, when Spain was exploding, it was an exciting place to live. And Madrid, there was a thing called the Movida Madrileña, when actually Madrid went mad. And it was just everything was going all day, all night. You know, it was quite a good place to be. So I actually got a bit of a second wind, I suppose you could say.
It sounds quite an exciting time to have moved to Spain and quite an exciting place to be. For you, what were the real attractions of Spain at that moment? Obviously, you've been in Latin America, so you've been speaking Spanish, I assume.
Yeah, I mean, as I said, I wasn't a lifestyle refugee, so I didn't come I came to get work. But yeah, I think actually the time I went there was particularly interesting because freedom was coming to the country. So there was an atmosphere of great optimism and good music and all sorts of things were going on, you know. So, I mean, that plus obviously I got a job and I got a work in the British Council. And so it all worked out okay.
Now, you've mentioned a couple of times in our conversation so far that you spent a little bit of time in South America. And in our pre-chat, you talked to me about that experience and talked to me about how that was a moment or a time in your life where you started to feel something that you might describe as being European. Can you explain a little bit more about that realization of being European?
Yeah, I was living. I lived for a year. I got a job in a place called Santa Cruz de la Sierra, which is a kind of was at the time a cowboy town in the east of Bolivia. And I worked in an American school, a U.S. school, with North Americans, and so I had contact with Bolivians and I had contact with North Americans, and I did feel I was more European than sort of Anglo in that sense because of attitudes towards lots of things. One, the most important thing is the attitude towards the past, and I think that, for example, North Americans it's a new country in terms of the settlers anyway, and every lifespan is very important. And in Europe, I mean, we're surrounded by old buildings. There's been dozens and dozens and dozens of generations of our families. And I think, you know, we have a different perspective. So we probably don't regard ourselves as quite as important. And I think that is quite an interesting thing, really. So what I mean to say is interesting because you realize that actually Britain is very much a part of Europe culturally in the wide way. And it's often people miss that because of the language, you know, and a language actually doesn't always unite. As somebody said, you know, that the States and Britain are two countries divided by the same language. You know, we miss out on the realization that we, as a culture, Britain and England have been very, very closely embedded in Europe, and our attitudes, our fundamental attitudes, are very similar. The same. They come from the same roots.
So you've indicated a little bit there about how this kind of longer history, and what that does to your sense of yourself as an individual, has a kind of European quality to it. And I wondered, for you personally, what it means to identify as European beyond that? What are the values that you associate with it?
I think the humanistic values that came out of the Renaissance, people like Erasmus and the Enlightenment, and their kind of core values in terms of equality, citizenship, as opposed to being subjects, and rights, human rights. That is the kind of core of European values, which came out of the 18th and 18th century, really. And before, but particularly in the 18th and early 19th century. You know.
It's really great the way that you've kind of brought together that Europeanness and citizenship, this kind of humanistic understanding of citizenship there. And I imagine that some of that has played into your thinking around Eurocitizens as well, which we'll go on to talk about in a minute. From your point of view, I mean, we haven't actually mentioned the B word yet. We haven't talked about Brexit at all. But I wondered if Brexit had presented you personally with kind of any challenges to that understanding of yourself as European. Because I think it's a personal identity too, isn't it?
It is, yeah. And I mean, when the referendum results came through, I felt completely gutted, like most of the people, a lot of the people who've made their lives in Europe. And I felt a sense of loss because I thought, well, I'm going to lose my European identity, you know, and I also might have problems with my life, you know, because things are not going to be the same. I won't have the same status as a non-European citizen, as a third country national, as I would do if I was a European citizen. So I, you know, basically it kind of really got me into thinking about doing something about it to fight for my rights, more as a kind of therapeutic thing. I think, you know, activism is therapy, I think, is very good. So I sent out a letter to people I know, and then, you know, we met together in September after a long Spanish summer and set up the group. And that's how it worked.
And that's a group, that's Eurocitizens, your group, that you set up at that point in 2016. And the idea behind that was born out of, as you've said, this kind of sense that something was being taken away from you on a kind of a fundamental level in relation to identity, but also potentially in terms of rights and status.
Yeah, yeah. And it was a campaigning group. I mean, there are different kinds of groups within British and Europe. Some are more based on dealing with the sort of general interests of British citizens living in the EU. Our main aim was campaigning, to campaign to keep our rights, campaigning on things like Spanish nationality, ways in which people could get Spanish nationality more easily, and also we lose our British nationality. So also campaigning for dual nationality.
So really taking those particularities of what was possible within the context of Spain as well as part of that discussion.
Yeah, exactly. And also thinking about Spaniards living in Britain. I mean, so it wasn't just the concept of what it's called Eurocitizens. It wasn't just a group of Britons, of what some people would call expats. Rather, you know, to talk about, because rights go both way. And obviously, you know, Spaniards in the UK have suffered as much as we have in terms of loss of rights and uncertainty, and all, you know, the whole process has been traumatic for both sides. And one of the best things is the way we've worked together with the Spanish through the 3 million, as obviously British and Europe has done. So it's actually united both citizens on both sides. And I think that's about the most positive thing that's come out of it.
And I suppose that also shifts the focus a little bit towards defending the rights of Europeans specifically. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit more about the decisions or the rationale, I suppose, would be a better way of putting it, behind the kind of establishment of Eurocitizens along those lines.
I think we were thinking that it would be more effective anyway, campaigning from both sides than actually just campaigning from one side. And actually that has proved the case. So when we've had meetings with the Spanish government, particularly key meetings, we had a meeting with the Spanish foreign minister at the end of 2017. And it was a joint meeting between us, Eurocitizens, and a Spanish group and somebody from the 3 million. So, and all the way along the line, we've from the beginning, we've been in touch, we've sort of worked together. And that has actually helped us in what we do. Because actually, when you're only talking from the point of view of a foreign citizen living in the country, you're in a weaker position than actually if you say, well, actually, we're together on this one. And representatives of the Spanish community in Britain have come over here as well. We've organized round tables and things like that on citizens' rights, and they've come over and spoken. They spoke at our demonstration, one of our demonstrations. So, you know, it's been an ongoing relationship, which has been very productive. And so it's actually not only been, it came out of, I think our awareness that as Britons in the country, we would be stronger if we joined together. And that's been the case.
So, I mean, we're now into 2020. So this will have been going now for nearly 4 years, Eurocitizens. And I know that also, you know, as I introduced you and as you introduced yourself, you've been centrally involved in the work of British in Europe. What has being involved in those campaigns been about for you? Obviously, you've talked about the rights, you've talked about what's changing, you've talked about the value of working together. But what about for you personally?
It's been a great experience in the sense that the people in the group I work with in Eurocitizen are fantastic, and we've had good fun. I mean, we've organised things. We had a concert first, I think it was in 2017, we had a concert called Music Without Frontiers, basically focusing people's attention on the position of creative people who are going to be affected by Brexit, particularly musicians. And that was great fun. You know, we got a place in a venue in central Madrid and had three or four young performers who were British and who'd been affected by would be affected by Brexit. And it was great fun. We've had various demonstrations, sort of camping outside the British embassy and involved with other European groups in central Madrid. And then we organized in 2019, just before the first original Brexit date, we organized a demonstration in Margaret Thatcher Square in Madrid, and which was good fun because we had lots of competitions and, you know, placard competitions with children and songs. We had a bagpiper and lots of media. I mean, the media all over us. So it was good fun and effective at the same time.
I think that's a really important identification of the need for solidarity and the work that goes into producing solidarity, the fact that there's also some enjoyment to be had in those moments. That's part and parcel of it, as well as kind of communicating outwards what the issues are, in defending of kind of the approach to free movement and European citizenship that you'd all been living by or had come to live by.
Yeah, no, definitely. And I mean, it's also very good working with people who are good at what they're doing. And I mean, the British and Europe steering group is quite outstanding. I don't think I've ever worked with such a kind of high level, high powered and efficient and effective and people who haven't got, there's no ego and everything works, you know, it's brilliantly. We've been very lucky, actually. And, you know, voluntary groups aren't always the easiest of things to organise, and all kinds of things can happen. But we've been very lucky. And I mean, in British and Europe, it's been fantastic.
One of the things that comes up really frequently when I'm talking with British citizens who live in Europe is the question of how Brexit has impacted on their understandings of Britain and Britishness. So this kind of view from afar. And we haven't touched on that today. And I just wondered if you had any thoughts on that.
I think it's a matter of overlapping identities. Brexit and the whole journey of citizens' rights has made me much more aware of my identities, plural, rather than my identity. And because I know that now, and it's something you make explicit and you think about things. It's like I now know more about my rights, you know, than I did before the 23rd of June 2016. But in terms of identities, you know, I mean, I know I've got different overlapping identities. I can be English, I can be a bit Welsh, British, Spanish, European, and those are identities that fit together.
One of the things that you did quite soon after Brexit, if I remember rightly, is that you started that process of applying for Spanish citizenship.
Yeah.
I think that was something that you'd thought about before, but what was it about Brexit that made you think, right, okay, now I've just got to do this now?
Well, it was both identity and everyday practicality, you know. I mean, having been lived here for so long and having no rights really angered me. So I had to get it together, you know, and I put off doing it because it's a pain in the neck. But it was worth doing, you know. And I got it last year in September, so.
I mean, unlike quite a few other European countries, there haven't been a huge number of British citizens applying for Spanish citizenship, probably because of the issues around dual nationality.
But also the process that, you know, you have to be resident for 10 years. It's actually harder than the processes in Britain for EU citizens. And that's one thing we've been campaigning about.
To change the rules around dual citizenship.
Well, dual nationality, yeah. And basically also, I mean, once you've actually put everything in, you know, people have had to wait up to 5 years to get a reply, which is really bad news. So that's been another issue we've been complaining about. And they have reacted. They did react and cleared the decks a bit on that one. So, you know, there's that issue to deal with as well. So once you've been through your 10 years, you've jumped through all the hoops, and then you have to wait another 5 years. You know, it's a long time.
Yeah, a really long time. So, and all sorts of things can happen in the intervening time, I suppose, as well, which is what the concerns would be there. I suppose one of the other issues that I have been addressing with people is their frustrations around how they are misunderstood. The ever circulating myths about who the British are who live in Spain or who live in Europe. And I've been really keen to actually try and myth bust around some of this. But I wanted to hear from you about if there was one myth about British citizens who lived abroad that you would like to bust, what would it be?
I think that we don't love our country, that we're kind of skiving just because we're going off to somewhere which has got nicer weather. And actually, British citizens abroad have a huge impact economically and culturally and whatever on Britain. I mean, I worked for 10 years for British organisation, British Council, and then I worked for 25 or 30 years writing English language textbooks for a British publisher. And that's So we actually contribute to Britain's soft power in a lot of cases. And we're not skiving, you know, okay, we don't pay tax, but we're not tax exiles either, because actually tax for here is higher than it would be for me in Britain. I'd be much better off as an author being in Britain than I am here. So this idea that we're kind of getting, you know, that we're not properly British, and it's, you know, it comes out of a rather insular attitude of Britain towards its diaspora, towards its emigrants. Other countries are much more understanding. You know, France and Spain realize that actually it's good for the country for people to come and for people to go, because that's what happens. And in Britain, you know, after 15 years, you lose your vote. We have no representation. Our MPs don't represent us. You know, we are left out in the cold. And I think Britain's attitude to both its immigrants and to its emigrants has a lot to be desired.
I think that's a really good way of kind of pulling together how emigration could be considered within the broader context of Britain's migration story in some ways. And yet I can hear your frustrations about, you know, the assumptions that because you don't live there, you don't care, I suppose, is essentially what that's about. Or that for some reason, because you don't live there and you've chosen to live somewhere else, that makes you less British, which I think comes through time and time again.
Yeah, and I think people, I mean, there's an attitude that people, okay, if people go and live in Australia or Canada, that's okay, or New Zealand, that's okay. But if they go and live with someone, you know, where they speak a funny language, and it's a bit different. So yeah, it's to do with insularity, I think. It's a kind of, and it's very strange, because I mean, Britain has produced more emigrants than any other country in Europe. I mean, we've covered the world with Britons, basically. And that's, and it, I think one of the key things is the fact that Britain hasn't really come to terms with its empire. And that's one of the, that's the key to Brexit. It's the key to a lot of things. There's a sort of, there's a kind of self-delusion about the empire and an unwillingness to meet up to realities, you know.
I was just wondering though, Michael, I mean, you've been out of the UK since the early 1980s, so talking about coming up to 40 years, is that myth something that you've always felt was present, or is it something that you think has come to light more recently?
No, I think it's something that's come to light more recently, because I think actually attitudes have kind of towards empire have changed. They've almost gone backwards in the last 40 years, because really when I was, you know, in the university in the late 1970s, it was the attitude to empire was, I think, more realistic than now. I think it's because there's a certain glorification of empire, and there's been a new kind of English nationalism that's developed around the foundation myth of the Second World War, which wasn't around in the 1970s.
Thank you very much, Michael. Is there anything that you'd like to add that I've just missed out entirely?
No, I don't think so, because I think we went through it pretty clearly. Just thank you for doing all this, and thank you for your work on migration. I think it's a really interesting area which has been neglected, you know, the British diaspora.
Yeah, I think much in the same way as the British diaspora has been kind of written out of public consciousness and out of political understanding, it's also been supported by not really being addressed properly in academic literature. So I've spent 18 years doing it. I will carry on. and yes, thank you so much, Michael.
No, not at all, Michaela. Thank you.
You've been listening to the Brexit Brits Abroad podcast with me, Dr. Michaela Benson. If you're not already subscribed to the podcast, you can do so by searching for Brexit Brits Abroad on iTunes and Libsyn. And to join in the conversation, follow us on social media. We're on Twitter and Instagram at BrexpatsEU, and you can visit our Facebook page, Brexit Brits Abroad. To find out more about the project, visit our brand new website, that's brexitbritsabroad.org. And I'll be back in a couple of weeks with the next episode.